When you think of the summer travel season, taking a ride on the railway might not be what leaps to mind. But there was a time when travel on a train meant adventure, even mystery and danger. Like in the 1974 film Murder on the Orient Express, where the train is almost a third character as a soon-to-be-murdered man makes the detective an offer.
10,000? 15,000.
Mr. Ratchet, I have made enough money to satisfy both my needs and my caprices. I take only such cases now as interest me, and to be frank, my interest in your case is dwindling.
British author and broadcaster Mark Ovenden has had a longtime love affair with trains, which he writes about in his book, Railway Maps of the World. In it, Mark tells us that railways have been more than a means of transportation. They've helped to build cities and bring supplies to war fronts. Even train maps and posters themselves have stories to tell, and you can see some examples at hereandnow.org. We spoke to Mark Ovenden about Railway Maps of the World last June and asked him, what does a railway map of a country tell us about that country?
I think it tells us, first of all, about the fantastic history of the building of that country. When you look at, for example, North America and across the Asian landmass, you can see how there were basically no cities in the middle of those big continents until the railways came along, because it was impossible to get heavy things. I mean, nobody was travelling any faster than somebody on the back of a horseback, remember? So it was impossible to make inland cities. And without the railways, we never would have built all those wonderful networks across the centre of our landmasses and had the ability to live in the centre of the world, away from the waterways. And you think about back in the 1820s, 30s and 40s, when people were surveying those lands. In many cases, they'd never even been to these places. They just thought, we have to build a railway from one side of the country to the other. And little teams of people had to go out and survey that land for the first time. In fact, railway cartography actually helped the growth of cartography itself, because we didn't quite know how to measure a distance, a straight line across a country, and build a railway through the middle of it.
Well, let's go back to the origins of modern railroads. You write that though its predecessors go all the way back to Greece, it really started in Europe and America in the 1800s. Can you remind us of that history?
Well, you've got that whole industry coming together, the Industrial Revolution coming together, where you had things like coal and water supply and raw materials to fuel the Industrial Revolution, the moving of the ordinary people from the farmlands straight into the new evolving cities. You had places like Liverpool connecting with Manchester, and they had canals originally, but the canal owners were charging too much money, so they wanted a new way to get the goods backwards and forwards between those two urban areas, and that formed the first major intercity line, the Liverpool to Manchester railway.
So it's really a driving force for the economy for most of the 19th century.
A lot of people cite the railways as the key driving force of the entire modern world.
We rely on maps to be accurate. And yet, in your chapter, Mere Marketing or Pure Propaganda, you talk about cartograph fibs. Is that what you call it? Did I say it right? what is a cartograph fib?
Well, it's the way that people lie using cartography. And there were lots of examples of this right back to the earliest days of making maps, because obviously railway companies at the beginning, certainly in America and most of Europe, were all private companies. So their lines would often be competing with similar lines. And they wanted to try and over-exaggerate their lines' practicalities over the one that was next door to get the dollars in. So quite a lot of maps came out right from the very earliest days, from the 1860s, 70s and 80s, which were really quite untrue in what they were trying to portray. There was lots of exaggeration of the benefits of one line over another.
And some of the other fibs you cite are political, to sort of draw the lines of the railway according to political agendas, or geometry, drawing straight lines rather than curves, right?
Where people just decided to just erase the meanders and the bylines and the small offshoots of lines and just draw a straight line city to city and say that's the railway network. And I love that way that people have used the maps to make the most of their system, or to overemphasize the easiness of use. I think there's one in there from the whole of Europe in the 1930s, which makes it look as if you could just get on a train in Istanbul and just get off again in London. But of course, in reality, you would have had to change trains five or six times, go across international frontiers. The time it would actually take you to do those journeys would have been a lot longer than the map tends to make you believe.
Well, as you point out, though railways were the key to U.S. growth in the 19th century, by the mid-20th, cars were replacing trains in the U.S. But Japan and China then started to build their own railways. Why?
Well, I think this is all to do with the pace of development. If you think about how amazing somewhere like America was and parts of Europe, where literally thousands and thousands of kilometres of railways have been built, connecting even some of the smallest, tiniest little hamlets. And then, as you say, the car lobby and the importance of the oil industry took over. But at the same time, some of the less well-developed countries, China and India, oddly enough, they had quite good railway networks, but there are other parts of the world that didn't have very much at all. And they were, of course, then catching up. And then you had this amazing revolution in the 1960s of the high-speed trains, kicked off, of course, by the wonderful bullet trains of Japan, but also followed up by the French and the Germans and the Spanish, who all developed high-speed networks, and now the Chinese, who are just racing ahead, building so much railways. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I understand they want to build 25,000 kilometres by 2020.
I mean, that would be enough to serve any medium-sized country anywhere else in the world. But for China, that's just going to try and link all the major population centres.
You have a chapter on the world's greatest rail routes, including the Trans-Australian Railway, the Orient Express, the Trans-Siberian, which I've always wanted to take myself. Do you have a favourite?
Yeah, I would love to go on the first one you mentioned, actually. I would love to go on the Trans-Australian because, you know, they have that long stretch of railway, which is the longest stretch of straight line in the world. Now, that might sound quite boring to some people, but just the idea of a railroad just ploughing straight through the desert, no bends, no kinks, no turns, just a straight line ahead for something like 370 kilometres is absolutely mind-blowing. And, of course, you're looking at, you know, that amazing scenery. But the wonderful ones you mentioned, the Orient Express, oh, I would love to go on one of those.
We're talking to you from New York City, so I'm wondering if you've explored the trains in and around the city.
Yeah, I love exploring. Wherever I go, I try to take the train. In fact, I've almost made us miss our planes out of various different holiday destinations with me and my friends when I've said, oh, I just want to go and see this metro system or railway station. And I would jump off the train and take photographs and the train would pull out and they'd be going, oh, my goodness me, get back on. We've got to get on. We've got a plane to catch. So I've got a bit of reputation, really, I'm afraid, of trying to take pictures of strange railway stations.
Well, how long have you been fascinated by trains?
You know, I think it was because I was brought up in the UK in the 1960s. The railways were being shut down in that country by a thing called the Beeching Acts. And so, therefore, loads of infrastructure was just left rotting. Old train stations, literally old trains were left. And me and my dad would just go walking along these old railway lines, you know, marvelling at it all on the one hand, but also being very sad on the other, that this infrastructure was no longer there. So I think I've got my dad to thank for this, actually. And both of my mum and dad were quite good public transport takers, and they would hand down maps to me, and I ended up making a small collection of rail and transit maps from all over the world, which, you know, got bigger and bigger. And even though I went off, as you said at the beginning, and became a broadcaster, I always had this passion in my heart to try and do something with this little collection of maps, and I've been so grateful to be able to put these together and bring these books to people.
That's Mark Ovenden. His book is Railway Maps of the World. Mark, thank you.
Thank you, Monica.
We spoke with Mark Ovenden in June 2011. To see some of the maps we've been talking about, go to hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. Our producers include Lynn Menegon, Hitesh Hati, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Rachel Rohr, Alex Ashlock, and Jill Ryan. Our interns are Joseph DiNatale, Sarah Faisal, and Alex Johnson. Our technical director is Doug Shugarts, Chris Ballman is the managing editor, and the senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Monica Brady-Meyerhoff. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.